out with someone, to having sex with them, and everything in between is included. But what's important is that there's no emotional attachment. The percentage of people that I know that's hooked up is 100%. Everyone around you is having sex. I think it is an affirmation that you feel desired and you feel sexy. Yeah, I think that girls use picking up as an empowering thing. Slam!
Like, if I tell one of my girlfriends, yeah, we hooked up, what do you mean? What'd you do?
Why is that shameful? You're proud that you're a sexual human being and that you are attractive and you're independent.
I met my boyfriend and we did hook up early on in our relationship, and alcohol played a big role.
I had beer goggles. Just having physical experiences with guys, I would end up feeling really empty a lot of the time.
I have known very few people that hooked up initially and then went on to have a meaningful relationship.
That's a little audio from NBC's Today Show. Girls, young girls, college-age girls, high school-age girls talking about the hookup. It's the new social standard for, they used to call it free love, I think, in the 60s. We're going to be talking about this NBC Today Show segment on the hookup culture with Jennifer Roback Morse here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Jeff's got girls at home, little girls at home, and I imagine that the term hookup strikes fear in his heart. I've got a teenage girl at home, and it strikes terror in my heart. We're going to be talking about that culture, where it came from, and where it's going here in the first half hour. After our conversation with Jennifer Roback Morse, Bill Beckman will join us for about 15 minutes. The Illinois House voted last week Thursday to allow public funding for adult and embryonic stem cell research. I think they're thinking that there's something there to make everyone happy. We'll find out what Bill of Illinois Right to Life has to say when we talk with him. We've got audio open lines, a ton of stuff for you. Starting near the end of this hour, a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly story about two pregnant women with babies that had major birth defects. Catherine Jefford Shorey is commenting on the rift in worldwide Anglicanism, largely due to her church body's position on gay marriage. She also has a few things to say about the exclusive claims, but she wouldn't say exclusive, the non-exclusive claims of Jesus Christ. And a little later in Audio Open Lines, Hannity and Combs did an interview with Senator Barack Obama's pastor. I wouldn't even call this an interview. I would call it two people talking at the same time for about 3 or 4 minutes. We'll see if we can make any sense of it. Coming up in Audio Open Lines, and then from 5 to 6, last night it was on the air, and then Ted Koppel had a big roundtable discussion debate afterwards. The Discovery Channel's documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa will join us here in studio from Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis to get his reaction to the documentary and the discussion that followed. I'll call in numbers as we come to you live this Monday, the 5th of March, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jennifer Roback Morse taught economics for 15 years at Yale University and George Washington University. She's a research fellow for the Acton Institute and author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Jen, I'd like your thoughts on what you heard from the girls there from that NBC Today Show package.
Well, I think they're probably pretty typical, and I think they're sadly typical. What was absent from the clip that you just played is any sense of regret about some of these encounters and some of the sort of sense of emptiness that they feel. And they did go on in that later in the segment that some of them admitted, yeah, it feels kind of cruddy sometimes. And then they interviewed a couple of authors on some of the downside of the hookup culture. And I think that's it's encouraging to me that some adults are starting to talk about this and take seriously some of the problems with it.
Well, let's go through the rest of the package from NBC's Today Show on the hookup culture. We'll stop and start it and get your reaction to it, Jennifer. This comes from NBC's Today Show about what is now apparently standard, the social construct for young women and young men and their sexual relationships.
So what does all this hooking up mean for young women? Laura Sessions Stepp is the author of a new book called Unhooked, How Young Women Pursue Sex, Delay Love, and Lose It Both. And Amber Madison is the author of Hooking Up, A Girl's All-Out Guide to Sex and Sexuality. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Laura, I want to start with you because you followed three groups of young women, one group of high school students and then two groups of college students.
Right.
Over the course of a year, really
right.
examining this term,
right.
hooking up.
Right.
What did you find out?
I had been following young people for 10 years, and I kept hearing this phrase, friends with benefits, hooking up. I wanted to know, what does it look like in the life of a girl all year? What I found was that they did have, as are those young women who actually are in, two of those are in my book, they did hook up, but they also had sort of short-term relationships. The problem with when they were in the relationship was the lack of trust, because hooking up, the defining characteristic is the ability to unhook at any time. It's a lack of commitment, and it has become the norm. We, all of us, probably had casual flings.
I was going to ask you, how is it different than casual sex back in the 60s and 70s?
That's a good question. I get that a lot. Free love in the 60s was also part of a political movement. It was sort of, and it had the word love in it. Hookups do not have love in them. They are, by definition, non-committed relationships.
It had the word love in it, but it really was about sex. Ultimately.
It was about sex, but it was also about anti-Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It was a statement of defiance. This is simply an ability to have sex without commitment.
Jennifer, your thoughts here. What is the relationship in your mind between the free love, sexual revolution culture of the 60s and 70s and the hookup culture of today?
Well, I think that what you're seeing is this process of unconnecting relationship from sexuality. The process is a continuing, ongoing process, so that what started off as something that seemed like a political act of defiance in the 1960s has developed into a full lifestyle choice that has much less meaning and substance to it than anything that Laura Sessions was claiming for it there in that clip. And I do think she's a little bit, shall we say, I don't want to say deluded, because that makes it sound like she doesn't know what she's saying, but I think she is putting the best possible face on it, let's put it that way, for the behavior and the attitudes of the people in the 60s. I think that a lot of people claimed it was a political act of defiance, but in point of fact, it was largely about sex, and people were looking for reasons to justify and legitimate the idea that they could pretty much do what they want to do. And the political situation offered that to them. Now, I think people feel much less need to rationalize what they're doing. You know, they're just more or less doing what they want. And because relationship is no longer part of the picture, we have institutionalized ways and institutionalized expectations that people don't have to really connect with other people, that sex and relationship are completely independent things. And it takes a while for people to come to believe a thing like that. And the 60s laid the groundwork for it. But now that process has pretty much completely unfolded, and you can see the results of it.
Do you think it surprises the advocates of the sexual revolution to see their kids or grandkids simply removing the veneer of love or politics and saying, this is about casual sex?
I don't think they can be surprised by it. I honestly don't think they can be surprised by it. I have to say, it's not like I have interviewed a lot of those people and know what they think, but I think that many people in that situation may be uncomfortable with what their kids or grandkids are doing, but don't feel they have the moral authority to say anything about it. You know, they are tongue-tied when it comes to saying, now, hey, wait a minute, this is way out of line compared to with what we were doing. Yeah, never mind what I said I did. You know, this is too much, and you should not be doing that. They really feel themselves to be morally compromised in a way, because they are morally compromised. They have not fully repented of what they did themselves, and so it's very hard for them to just come out and say, hey, kid, knock it off. This is not going to work.
Dr. Jennifer Robach-Morris is our guest, author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Love, Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Back to the Today Show segment on the hookup culture.
Amber, you're a recent college graduate. Mm-hmm. Do you agree that hooking up does not involve any emotional commitment?
No, I think hooking up just means sexual activity, but it doesn't necessarily mean sexual activity with no emotional commitment. Like, I could say, oh, I hooked up with my boyfriend last weekend, just meaning we had some kind of sexual activity, but that's in a situation where clearly there are emotions involved as well.
But if you're hooking up with every Tom, Dick, and Harry, see, this is my problem mm-hmm. as a parent, because I find this a little upsetting. How can you ever have any emotional commitment if every other day there's another guy or another gal?
Well, I think the real issue here is that women my age are very much afraid of relationships. And I think they hook up as right. a result of being afraid of mm-hmm. relationships, as opposed to the hookups actually leading them to be afraid of relationships. And to me, a big issue is girls are brought up with this idea, okay, you know what, all a guy wants from you is sex, and guys don't want emotional commitment. And when girls get that kind of message, they're afraid to go after relationships because they think it's unattainable. And something I did in my book, I have a whole chapter dedicated to the crazy idea that, oh my God, men have emotions and they enjoy relationships, they enjoy marriages, they eventually want to get married, right? And that they're really people too, because I think that gives women the empowerment to look at men and say, okay, you could be interested in me for more than sex.
Your reaction here, Jennifer, what are you hearing there?
Well, she said it with her mouth. She came right out and said it. It's not really about empowerment, it's about fear. I mean, I've been saying that for years, Todd, as you know, and as your listeners know, that the sexual revolution is basically about a retreat, a massive retreat from human relatedness. And she admitted it. She said it. Now, what I think the cause that she's assigning to it is that, oh, we've been brought up to think that men are all beasts. Well, you've also been brought up to think, you go, girl, and you can have what you want, and it doesn't really matter. In effect, what the sexual revolution has tried to do is to institutionalize the impulses of the adolescent boy. That we're supposed to all enjoy sex the way a teenage boy would enjoy sex, and never really take the next step to ask, well, gee, don't teenage boys want to grow up too? You know, because in fact, eventually they do. And I think I was quite encouraged by the fact that she is noticing that men ultimately do want more than their hookups. I think that's quite right. But the other thing that's absent from this whole discussion, and I listened to this segment too, and they never do get around to talking about this, Todd, and that is there is now a tremendous amount of evidence linking casual sex to depression for young women. It's a very strong finding that casual sexual activity increases a person's risk something like two to three times raises your probability of becoming depressed. And it's not just that girls who are depressed use sex to medicate themselves. No, you look at it in order, in this time sequential order, and it's very plain that the sexual experiences themselves are leading to a higher probability of depression. And I think that's perfectly understandable when you realize that sex is all about the body trying to create a relationship, and we're doing everything we can to thwart sort of the natural impulses of the heart, mind, and soul, which is that sex and relationships should be connected.
Real quick, before we go back to the audio, Jennifer, does the hookup scenario, to really, for your answer to Meredith Vieira's question, does it erode the ability of young people to later form real relationships?
Oh, I think it does. I think that it does. Actually, I think it does. I think that part of what happens to people is they become jaded and they become calloused and they practice cutting themselves off from some of their feelings because there's simply a lot of pain involved. And as the one author mentioned, there are trust issues going all through those kinds of relationships. And so people hold back from developing real trust. And in fact, one of the things you see, even with cohabiting couples who later get married, you see a tendency for there to be trust issues going through the whole relationship, which they need to work on and address if they're going to, you know, really have the kind of happy marriage that they would like to have. Unfortunately, not everybody is aware of how common that pattern is, and so people are struggling and sort of flailing around with something that it would really be in their interest to realize that it's there in the first place because you could deal with it.
But a lot of girls are saying, like in that tape, that's right, this is about empowerment, but what you're basically saying is it isn't.
Well, girls also aren't sure they want relationships because they have careers. These are busy girls. They have careers, they have education they want to get accomplished, they want to be great in sports. We've told them, you go, girl, you can have everything you want. They don't really feel like they have time for the emotional messiness of a relationship. And so hooking up to them makes some sense. It's you can sort of play at having a relationship without really investing yourself.
So, Jennifer, what do you make of that explanation, that this is an effective use of young people's time?
I hear that all the time. I hear that all the time. It's actually a variation on what the other girl had already said, which is that people are afraid of relationship, and they'd rather throw themselves into their studies and their career rather than take the time and take the emotional risk involved in investing themselves in a relationship. So I think the two things go hand in hand with one another. And once again, in effect, girls are being told to take on the posture of the adolescent male, which is to invest yourself in your sports and your cars and all your fun things that you're doing, and, oh, by the way, you know, have a casual fling once in a while and don't feel very much about it. But unfortunately, women are not really that capable of putting away all those feelings, because the feelings are a natural part of the bodily response to sexuality. Women tend to bond with their partners. It's a very well-documented physiological fact that women will attach to their sex partners, and that makes it much harder to have the casual sexual relationship that girls think they're supposed to have, that girls think they're entitled to have. And that, I think, is why depression is such a common outcome for so many girls.
Here's more on the hookup culture from Today's show.
Well, what do you think of the long-term consequences, something like this, Amber?
I mean, I think that there's no conclusive evidence that shows anything about long-term consequences of hooking up and what it means. I think the important thing here is that we acknowledge hooking up is happening, and that's a norm. And we can say we like it, we can say we don't like it, we can say it has consequences or it doesn't have consequences, but really what we need to address is teaching girls how to make better decisions. And I think that means not dictating it's wrong to hook up outside of a relationship and it's right to hook up in a relationship, but saying, you know what, you need to really think about what feels good for you and analyze, hey, last time I was in this situation with this guy, did it make me feel good afterwards? And if the answer is no, giving them the empowerment to walk away.
And very quickly, the role that parents should play in this?
Okay, before we get to the parents' role in this, I want you to respond to the two points she made, that there's no conclusive evidence of long-term consequences to the hookup scenario. And then her second one is that this is really just about making girls smarter about who they hook up with and when. Jen?
It depends on what you're willing to accept as evidence. You know, I mean, she seems to be unaware of the evidence which I just cited to you, which is that the very strong correlation with depression. So, you know, does that count or not? I mean, why would you not include that as a serious consequence? And secondly, on the other point, I think she's very unrealistic about the possibility of women just walking away. I mean, that's the whole issue. I mean, the fact is that because of the hormonal response of oxytocin that women naturally experience when they're being sexual, we do tend to attach to our partners, and quite often we attach to guys who really aren't very good for us, and we don't really make very good judgments. So I think she's simply kidding herself about that, to think that it's possible for a girl to just say, oh, well, this isn't working, I'm out of here. Well, of course, you'd like to be able to do that, but I think you need a more conscious strategy for being able to do that, one that takes into account the fact that there may be a part of you that's operating that's not completely rational. So you have to have a backup plan, like you have to have someplace else to go or a girlfriend to call if you get into thus and so situation that you know from experience is bad for you. To just say, oh, well, I mean, you know, since the beginning of the sexual revolution, girls have been told to be empowered in exactly the way that she describes, and I don't think it has been particularly effective.
Well, it strikes me that if it's just about girls being smarter about who they hook up with, we heard from one of the girls in that opening dialogue of the young ladies that their hookups often involved alcohol. That impairs judgment. It strikes me also that young men might simply adapt by becoming more convincing hookup prospects for these young women. Guys are certainly capable of doing that.
Well, that's right. That's right. So, you know, like I said, I just don't think it's a very realistic strategy to say that we're just going to empower girls even more. And I also think, you know, look, ask yourself this. What if the topic were smoking or drinking and driving, and she were to say, you know, we just have to accept the fact that people drink and drive, and we just have to be a little smarter about drinking and driving. You know, smoking is a fact of life, and it's very addictive, and nobody's going to give it up. And, you know, we shouldn't be judgmental about smoking. You know, you would be laughed off of the TV set if you started talking like that. And so the idea that people can control themselves and make healthy lifestyle choices for themselves in every area except sex, that seems to be our current view, and I think that's crazy and really selling us short.
Very quickly, the role that parents should play in this?
Parents can inject the word love into the conversation. That's what's missing in this conversation. I'm not saying they should have less sex. I'm saying they should have more romance We never talk about love. We can model our own relationships. If a relationship, our own marriage is going bad, we can talk about how it was great in the beginning. If we fail in a relationship, we can say, but you know what, I can't wait to try again. The words love and relationship need to be part of this new national conversation that I think both of us would like to see happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's this old saying, why should I buy the cow if I can get the milk for free?
You know, and to me, I think that's just promoting the idea that, oh, this hookup culture is ideal for men, and all they want is sex anyway. And I really feel like it's so important. And the girls I know who understand, oh, guys see me as a person, and they're interested in who I am, and that I can make them laugh and have an intelligent conversation, not just getting in my pants, then it's irrelevant whether they hook up with a guy on a first date and go all the way or wait. Because what's really the issue is respect.
Okay, thank you
thank
both
you very,
very much.
Travis.
It's something that all parents should know about for sure. Laura Sessions, Stepp, and Amber Madison, thanks again.
All right, that's from this morning's Today Show on the hookup culture. Jennifer, your final thoughts here with about a minute.
Well, I think she's right that parents do need to inject the word love and relationship into the conversation. And she's also, the other girl is also right to be saying that, yes, that men want more than just sex. I mean, that's a bum rap that men have. But at the same time, I think it would be foolish to deny that men and women respond to sexuality and sexual activity very differently. And I think our big mistake has been to think that girls are entitled to act like guys and then expect ourselves to react in the same way that guys do. And the fact is that we really don't. Men and women both act differently and react differently, and I think we need to, she's right, we need to respect one another, but the idea that it's a matter of no consequence whether you go to bed with a guy on the first date or the third week into your relationship, you know, that seems to me to be crazy. That really understates the power of the sexual act and gives away way too much of the woman's power.
Our guest, Jennifer Roback Morris, has a website. It's Jennifer-RobackMorris.com, Jennifer-RobackMorris.com. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale University and George Mason University. She's a research fellow for the Acton Institute and author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Thank you very much, Jennifer. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, what are we looking at here? We're looking at, I think, an historian or a theologian might call this almost Gnostic dualism between the physical and the spiritual, or the physical and the emotional, that we can somehow subject our bodies to an act that God created for the union of man and woman to an end that is not the union of man and woman. Did you notice one thing that was also missing from the Today Show segment from this morning? Any conversation about marriage, the proper context of the sexual relationship. There's a reason why God put love and marriage together. It's because sex isn't just about the body. It's also about the person, and that sex belongs within marriage because it is not just about love, certainly not about free love, but about the love between a man and a woman that is lifelong and, in the context of marriage, God-pleasing. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the second half hour, at least the first part of it, with Bill Beckman. The Illinois House voted last week to allow public funding for both adult and embryonic stem cell research. That was Thursday's vote. We'll see what Bill Beckman, Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, has to say. And then at 3:45, we begin audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We're coming to you live this Monday, March the 5th, on Issues Etc.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, Senior Editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
A new study says doctors who perform assisted suicides suffer emotional and mental strain.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
According to a new study of doctors in Oregon and the Netherlands, many physicians who participate in assisted suicide and euthanasia face psychological problems. 24% of Oregon doctors said they regretted performing an assisted suicide, and 16% said that the emotional burden adversely affected their medical practice. The author of the study says the main reason this occurs is because performing euthanasia and assisted suicide violates the fundamental role of a physician to heal and promote human wholeness.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. There was a time when presidents spoke freely about God. Yesterday, March 4th, was the anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. The year was 1865. Listen to an excerpt from his speech and notice how theological his thoughts were and how theological he was allowed to be by the popular culture of that day. Lincoln said, "The Almighty has his own purposes. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South as terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." So far, the excerpt from Abraham Lincoln. Now, even if they are constrained not to speak that way today, let us pray that today's leaders certainly think that way. I'm Dale Meyer.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Might have seen the headline in Friday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. At least the Illinois edition had the headline, "House Gives Its Approval to Public Stem Cell Research." The big question one asks first at that point is, when you say stem cell research, what do you mean? Do you mean the humane stem cell research that is done with adult stem cells wherein no one dies in order to procure them? Or do you mean the inhumane stem cell research that destroys human embryos? Well, I guess it's both. We're going to talk about that decision on Thursday in the Illinois House with Bill Beckman, Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Then we begin audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Bill Beckman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Okay.
Glad to be with you.
Is this good news or bad news for the Illinois voter?
Well, this is very bad news for Illinois voter. It's effectively misuse of taxpayer funds for something that will be ineffective in the long term.
What is your concern about the vote that took place Thursday to allow public financing for stem cell research of both kinds, both adult and embryonic?
Well, of course, I mean, the problem is not with the adult stem cells. It does not involve killing, but with the unethical experimentation that kills embryonic human beings. And in that regard, the bill basically establishes an institute that allows the state government to sponsor such experimentation that would effectively require to achieve its result would require the killing of embryonic humans, and then use the stem cells that were derived from that to do experiments, which they are claiming will ultimately lead to impressive cures, but which so far have produced no cures that would in any way, shape, or form be tested on a human being.
I take it from the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that this House move on Thursday really is just a follow-up to what Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich had already done by executive direction some time back, I believe, in 2005. Tell us about what he did by executive order.
Well, yes. In fact, that in 2005, there was an item slipped in the budget which provided $10 million for some unknown research, and effectively after the budget was passed, he declared that the research that was being provided for was the research that was going to be funds distributed by this institute. So he declared the formation of this institute to do the allocation of such funds, and they did go through a process and distribute that money over the course of that year. And then the following year, he then found additional funds in a different budget to provide another $5 million. Now, the talk at this time is to provide $25 million in this current year for this research.
So, in other words, this is something that the governor decided to do on his own without consulting the legislature in any formal way. The legislature now is following suit, and not only giving him, at least in the House, the public funding he wants, but anticipating giving him quite a bit more public funding for the so-called Illinois Regenerative Medicine Institute.
Yeah, in fact, in the earlier years when he used the executive order, the legislature refused to pass these kind of bills, and that's what motivated him to do the executive order. Now, apparently, with the results of the November election last year, there's been more of an emboldening of people that have that persuasion, and the result has been this new vote. Now, there was also a vote in the Senate a few days earlier of another bill that has basically the same result. That was called SB4. So, effectively, both houses of the legislature have now passed virtually the same legislation to empower this institute to take place.
Is that why the Senate is fast-tracking this particular bill?
Right. At this point in time, if either body passes the other body's bill, it would go to the governor for his signature.
Is there any doubt as to what Blagojevich will do with it?
Well, given his past track record of executive order, absolutely not. I mean, it seems that this bill will become law. So the only remaining issue is the funding. Now, there is at least some question on the funding, because there have been in other states where effectively the first step that we've just seen pass both houses has occurred, and then because of concerns raised about budget issues and all that, that in reality, at least for a year or two, if not longer, that the funding component was delayed or eliminated, not allowed to happen. So we think it's still appropriate that people express their concerns and raise the issue about the funding. Obviously, this is a very serious first step, but there is still some hope that the process could be at least slowed down and potentially reevaluated because of the fact that this is an unethical violation of people's rights to their tax dollars be used in a way that would not be something that they would find objectionable. And in this case, there are so many very solid alternatives using stem cell sources, including from umbilical cord blood, and even now most recently from amniotic fluid, that are very encouraging and actually provide results that are virtually identical to all the results claimed for the potential of embryonic stem cells.
I noticed two things that were odd. One is that this was not a Republican/Democrat vote. It was not a party-line vote. It was genuinely bipartisan. In fact, it was championed in the House by Minority Leader Tom Cross, who's a Republican. Your thoughts there?
Well, unfortunately, and obviously we feel extremely, with him for his own family's health situation. I believe he has a daughter who has type 1 diabetes, and he's convinced that, you know, that getting this particular bill passed will basically lead to a cure for his daughter. You know, unfortunately, we believe that he's strongly mistaken in putting his efforts into a direction that's going to probably, if anything, delay finding that cure, because the effort will be placed in the wrong place. There's already been some progress, you know, using the other sources of stem cells that has been very encouraging, and for some reason, he and others who are pushing this particular direction seem to be ignoring that progress and saying that they need progress here, but that will probably, you know, result in less progress and progress that's not nearly as fast as what's needed for his daughter to actually benefit.
Representative David Miller has this quote in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story. He says, being a taxpayer, I think we owe it to those who do suffer from these debilitating diseases, who do suffer from things that could be preventable, to at least provide the opportunity for a quality of life for these citizens. What's your reaction to his sentiments?
Well, I think we can do that in a very ethical manner, because, like you say, the results using the other sources of stem cells have already demonstrated success with actual human treatments for 72 different ailments is the current count. And some of those treatments have actually gone past the experimental stage. Unfortunately, many of them are still considered in the experimental stage because too much effort is being spent on looking in these alternative directions that aren't necessarily going to be fruitful, as opposed to continuing to move forward with the areas where the progress is being made, so that those things can be turned from experimental treatments into standard treatments and allow the patients to get the benefit of those on a more consistent and regular basis.
One final question for you, Bill. The story says that both the Senate and the House bill in Illinois make it a felony, or have provisions in them that would make it a felony to clone or to attempt to clone a human being, and it's the first time that state law has spoken on this. Is this cloning, as you and I would understand cloning, any practice of somatic cell nuclear transfer to any end, or is it the tricky definition?
Part of the very scary part of this bill is to basically allow for the creation of human clones using the somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is the process for cloning. That's just the scientific term. And the net effect is that what the bill bans with criminal penalties is allowing that clone to grow and reach and be implanted in a woman and reach term and be born. So effectively, it's mandated killing of the clone.
It's a clone and kill bill.
Banning of cloning.
It's a clone and kill bill, as we could.
Yes, absolutely. It's the same kind of language that's been passed in a number of other states, like New Jersey, unfortunately, in Amendment 2 in Missouri, and in California, and a number of other states.
IllinoisRightToLife.org is the website address for Illinois Right to Life. Bill Beckman is Executive Director at Illinois Right to Life. Bill, thank you very much. Sorry you're bringing bad news, but we'll be talking to you sometime soon.
We need to share it so people understand.
Sure.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Well, for the remainder of this hour and going on into the next hour, we've got some audio open lines for your questions and your comment. Usually on Monday, we come in and there's a bunch of stuff waiting for us. That's the truth today. We're going to start out with the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly story about two pregnant women with babies that had major birth defects, staying on the life issue. And then a little later during audio open lines, Catherine Jefford Shorey has been speaking out on two issues. One, Catherine Jefford Shorey, of course, is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA. She has been speaking out on the issue of the rift, the theological rift between her province of Anglicanism and the majority of Anglicans worldwide over the issue of homosexual priests and bishops. She's also decided to have a few things to say, and this is nothing new from her, but to have a few things to say about whether or not Jesus is the only way of salvation for everyone. She says, no, not for everyone. For us, maybe, but not for everyone. And we'd like your reaction to everything we play here during audio open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Monday, March the 5th, and we're coming to you live. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. As time permits, a little bit later, Hannity and Combs did an interview with the pastor of the man who serves as the pastor for Senator Barack Obama, who, of course, is running for president on the Democratic ticket. He doesn't have the nomination yet, but then again, nobody does. He's one of those hopefuls. It was speculated that Barack Obama, because of his name and perhaps his family background, was a Muslim. Well, no, he's been objecting for a long time, saying, no, I'm a member of a United Church of Christ congregation. We'll see what they're teaching there in this interview with Hannity and Combs a little bit later during Audio Open Lines. First, let's hear this from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly about two pregnant women faced with children who had major birth defects.
Leslie, who is from Virginia, and Mary Jo, who lives in New Jersey, have a lot in common. They are both in their mid-30s, both church-going Presbyterians, both married, and of course each was happy when she first learned she was pregnant.
We were lucky. We got pregnant relatively soon. We were absolutely thrilled.
The two women had routine sonograms during their pregnancies, and for both, the news was a shock.
Everything was proceeding perfectly until about 18 weeks when we had an ultrasound that detected severe heart defects, mm-hmm. three major defects and one minor defect. Any of those by itself possibly could have been reparable, but together it was very, very bleak.
Bleak as well for Mary Jo.
The doctor came in and told us that he could not find a nose on the baby. He couldn't see a nose, and that's basically the only thing that he could tell us at that point.
The following week, a more detailed sonogram and more bad news for Mary Jo and her husband John.
He's missing a lot of the structures of his upper face. No nose, no eyelids, hole above his head. His feet are turned in. We don't know about brain damage. It's probably there, or else he wouldn't have had the club feet.
Both couples' doctors let them know right away that it was not too late to abort. And here their stories take different turns. For Leslie and her husband, Rob, coming to a decision was a long, agonizing struggle. She reads from a journal she kept.
April 27th. Now we are in hell. On Friday, we had the second ultrasound and a consultation with the doctor. The worst imaginable. Termination means having to deliver a baby at 5 months that has been kicking and active. Normal delivery means days to years of fragile life, hospitals, operations, and not knowing. I could write for hours about our confusion, despair, and depression, but I don't have the energy, and I'm not sleeping well these days.
I think when Mary Jo and John were given the option to abort, their decision was immediate.
Did you have a moment when you considered it?
No, I wanted this baby. I wanted to be the one that wanted to hold him.
My only question, of course, was her life in danger? And had it been, then I think we would have seriously considered the options in that regard. But when they ruled that out, then there was no further question.
We thought that that was a wonderful gift from God, and we just didn't want to give it up. And
no matter what?
No matter what. And the way I see it is when somebody gives you a gift, you don't reject it. You don't say no thanks.
That's how I see God does things that we don't always understand. In the end, they could be painful, but he has a purpose in them that's even better.
Now, here you see, this is a heart-wrenching dilemma. These two women both faced with children in their wombs with severe birth defects. The doctors are not hopeful about the prospects in any event. And both of them discover this through routine ultrasounds or sonograms. And both of them are faced with, or at least given the option of abortion. One of them says yes, and the other one says no. Now listen to the reasoning of the woman who said no. She says, no matter what, the way I see it is when someone gives you a gift, you don't reject it. You don't say no thanks. She's viewing this child in her womb, even with the birth defects, of course, as a gift. That might be a watershed in the decisions of these two women. Your reaction, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Audio Open Lines, Issues, etc. We're listening here during the first part to a story from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly about these two pregnant women whose babies had major birth defects. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Leslie and her husband chose a name for their baby, Clara, but continued to question whether she should live.
After 5 weeks of torture, agony, anger, tears, and talking about this nonstop, we decided to put an end to Clara's suffering before it got too unbearable for her and us. I ended up concluding that God gave us brains to think about what we should do, gave us medical procedures to help us when we needed it, gave us research, gave us all kinds of tools to better our lives. We felt like that God gives you the strength to do what you need to do and to make decisions for yourself.
Now, I've heard this before. Usually, she puts it in a more subtle way, the mother who decided to abort the child with birth defects. She puts it in a subtle way, but I've heard it in a more overt way. And that is, well, look, if God didn't want us to abort children, why would he make us able to do such a thing? If he didn't want us to do this, why would he have made us able to develop the sonogram so we can peer into the womb early in pregnancy, or doctors with the medical knowledge that they need to know about birth defects, or the abortionist with the so-called skills that he or she possesses to carry out this procedure? It is interesting that she refers to abortion as a medical procedure. I strongly disagree with that. It is a procedure. It's not a medical procedure. Medical procedures have one of three purposes: to treat, to alleviate pain, or to mollify symptoms. And abortion does none of those things. It simply takes a life in the womb. So it's a procedure, but not a medical procedure. And yet her reasoning simply is, well, God gave us the ability to come to this decision. He gave us the means to carry out this decision. So if he didn't want us to do this, why would he have made it possible for us to do it? How would you respond to that? 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Very recently I heard, I think it was a caller to this program when we were talking about embryonic stem cell research, say, if God didn't want us to harvest stem cells from living human embryos, he wouldn't have given us the ability to do it. How do you respond? Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Mary Jo and John see God's role in a different way.
The Bible says that when we believe in God, there's a promise made to you and to your children. The Bible really doesn't talk about heaven as the place we're going, ultimately. It talks about Jesus coming and recreating this earth and these bodies perfectly, without problems. So there's no more disease, and there's no more conflict, and there's no more natural disaster.
And you believe that is going to happen?
I do believe it, and so that is what sustains us.
Meanwhile, Mary Jo and John have a 16-month-old son, Jack. Their son, Gray, is now 3.5 years old. Gray has had 5 surgeries and each day endures a painful routine.
His eyes need to be white and there are drops that need to be put in his eye and ointments and things like that. Because his eyes are so open and exposed, it hurts him when I have to clean it. His nose also hurts a lot when I have to clean it and do all the things that I need to do. It hurts him a lot. Putting the brace on his arm hurts him a lot because I had to make it stay straight. I'm the one that has to say no when he says, Mommy, take it off. It hurts. I'm the one that has to say no.
Leslie now has 2 healthy children, Reed and Ava, who were born after Leslie's abortion. But Clara remains a part of this family.
No one will ever replace her. She has her own position in the family, and the children that come after are separate and their own entity.
He's alive. He has life. Who am I to sit there and say that quality of life is not up to some sort of speed?
Do you feel sadness sometimes, and what gets you through that?
All the time, yeah.
Yes. I'm sad all the time, especially when I have to do the things that I need to do to him. I definitely don't enjoy that, but my comfort is that I know that God knows exactly what I'm going through and that he's there to sustain me and to help me go through that and to help Gray be strong in that area.
You know, this is striking to me, the contrast between these two couples and how they understand God's role in the decisions that they made. One to abort her severely disabled child and the other couple to keep their severely disabled child, and the honesty with which the second couple that kept their child admit that this is sad, this is hard, this is painful, and yet they say they trust God for the outcome. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's listen just a few more minutes. I'm going to run straight to the phones after that. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Well, do you feel you made the right decision?
Yes.
In what sense?
That we made the best loving decision for her as we could at the time. And if we had to do it today, I would do the same.
At one point, Leslie wrote a letter to her daughter.
Dear Clara, this letter will be so hard for me to write. I hope that you forgive us for the agonizing choice that we believed was best. It is one no parent should ever have to make. I wanted to protect you. Hold us in your wings. And when I look at the stars, I know you are with me. I love you, my dear little angel, your mother. We will be with you soon.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Betty Rollin.
All right, I want to hear your reaction to this story. There's no doubt it's heart-wrenching, and there is no doubt that there's genuine sorrow on the part of on both sides of this story, but the outcome couldn't be any more different. Let's go to Jan in Atlanta and talk with her first. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I just have I offer prayers for both families, and I'm looking at James, the first chapter, where he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. Yes, God has given us the abilities to do medical procedures. He's given us the science to both improve and destroy life. But what I'm getting to is that just because we can, should we?
That's a great point, Jan. Thank you very much, and thanks for hanging on the line and listening in Atlanta. When we come back from this break, I'll have a few things to say in response to what Jan said there in her call, and we'll go back to the phones and your email, 1-800-730-2727. Or 505-7850, our in-studio email address, as we come to you this Monday, the 5th of January, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I am asking this question. The reasoning used by the couple for aborting their child is, hey, if God didn't want us to do this, then he shouldn't have given us the ability to make this decision. He shouldn't have given us the means of carrying out this decision, or even the circumstances in which we feel like we have to make the decision to abort our unborn child.